Food prices have increased over 40%. Energy prices have increased over 20%. Wheat and gas prices have increased over 70%. What's going to be next? Do you see these trends reversing or even stabilizing? All fiat currencies have always failed and collapsed their economies on their way down. The Roman Empire, China, France, Argentina, Finland, Mexico, Russia, and Zimbabwe all tried fiat currency and all collapsed into chaos. Meanwhile, the dollar has lost over 97% of its gold value since 1971, when an ounce of gold was valued at $35. If your assets are in paper, you are in danger. Protect your assets with gold and silver. Visit Discount Gold and Silver Trading at DGScoins.com. That's DGScoins.com or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 800-375-4188. Protect yourself and your family.
Ladies and gentlemen, I'm Melody Cederstrom, and you're listening to Financial Survival. My co-host, Alfred Addisk, and James Corbett of The Corbett Report will be joining you for the second and third segment of the program today. So let's get started with the market report for Thursday, November 12th, 2015. It's been a little tough day for gold anyway, but they tried to knock it down. It was a 107.4. Came back 10 bucks. We're at 1085. 1,085, only down 180. Silver was down 3 cents today at 1442. Platinum was also down $4 at 881, with palladium down 14. Palladium is just getting beaten up, $565. And again, those white metals, they're great for good economies during a good suspension of economic growth, because people buy automobiles, they buy jewelry, and with the prices of gold, a lot of them was going to white gold, and you use a lot of those white metals for jewelry and so forth. So big demand when you have great economies, and so I think we're seeing a lot of pressure because the commodity sector across the board certainly is down, and I think you will eventually see gold and silver break away from that platform. But we have to deal with these lower prices for gold and silver for the time being, which means pick up your phone, 1-800-375-4188. And I also think to the idea of higher interest rates, we certainly have seen a lot stronger dollar. I saw predictions that we'll see 108 on the index for the dollar. And I think, too, I think when it gets to those high numbers, I think you'll see other things happen in the economy where I don't think that's going to be a real bad number for gold and silver. I think the impact that we're seeing in gold and silver now is the anticipation of what's to come with the rate increases and so forth, even if they do it. I mean, we went through the same darn thing through, oh, are we going to taper off on the bond buying from the Federal Reserve? That went on for how many months? A year? Before they actually started to gradually decrease the quantitative easing the last time. So again, I think a lot of the pressure on gold and silver is due to the anticipation of that happening, of higher interest rates and that stronger dollar. The U.S. dollar today down a little bit, 0.40, 98.52. Crude oil got hit hard today, down 1.35 at 41.58. We're going to be talking about why some of these numbers, or at least some of the reasons that you know, the mainstream media produces to give you an idea of what is happening to the markets. We'll just touch on those briefly before we go on. The Dow Jones was down. Let's see if I can get some more current numbers. It looks like it was down. It was down triple digits most of the day, 254. 17,447. The NASDAQ was down 1.25%, 5,005. S&P down 29 at 2,045. 10-year yield, 2.32%. Euro 108. Of course, we knew that'd be stronger, 0.51. Of course, it was a light trading day yesterday with so many businesses closed. A large portion of the country didn't work yesterday due to Veterans Day. So, not sure if this is just a reflection of that or everything else that is going on. We're going to talk about some of those other things, excuse me, that are going on. Hong Kong was up big, 2.3% overnight. Europe, London, and Germany were both down over 1%, with London being down almost 2% on the day. As I mentioned, stocks and commodities fell. There were three Federal Reserve officials that reinforced the view that interest rates might rise this year. Copper fell to the to the lowest level since 2009, and the S&P fell through its 200-day average price. The Bloomberg Commodity Index, that sank to the lowest level since 1999. So their commodity index, 1999, hit the lowest level since then. And I remember what gold and silver were doing in 2000. I mean, that was right by before the tech bubble burst. We had a lot of pressure in gold and silver in 2000 and going into 2001. I mean, we were at 250 for how long? This is what this market reminds me of, going back to 2000 and 2001. You had a lot of pressure in gold and silver. Just as soon as it felt like it was going to move, man, they'd pop it right back to 250. And it would move up. It would maybe get to 350 and, you know, getting closer to 4. And boom, they'd pop it right back. And it really does remind me of the same markets. And that's why I disagree. I don't think we'll ever see, you know, some of these predictions, oh, 750, 800, about. No, I think what's going on, and look at the difference between the year 2000, 2001, prior to 9/11, and today. How can you even compare the two as far as what is going on in this economy? And so the Bloomberg Commodity Index sank to the lowest level since 1999, and I can see the correlation with gold and silver. As I mentioned, copper fell to a 6-year low. A lot of that was from the demand, the concern that the demand from China is weakening. So that fell 2.5%. You had aluminum, tin, lead, zinc, nickel. They all declined at least 1%. And as I mentioned before, you had the WTI, the West Texas Intermediate, that dropped about 2.8% to 41 below the around 41.73 level. And inventories rose 4.22 million barrels last week, and that was according to the EIA report, and that's the Energy Information Administration report. As I mentioned, the euros, the European equities, they slid. And, of course, Mario Draghi came out, and he hinted, oh, well, we'll do a little more stimulus for you, and we can't let things go too bad. We're here for you. We're here for you, you bankers and the stock market. So we'll do whatever is possible to keep those numbers higher. We could care less about the citizens as we see how many millions that'll refugees heading into these various countries and so forth to which they really can't service. And so we are back to the Fed officials who continue making a case for higher interest rates at their December policy meeting. And of course, you know, this is why we see this little rally in the dollar. You see a little bit of inflation expectations seem fairly well anchored. There was a chief market strategist, David Lafferty. He said that, you know, all the commodities are seeing this weakness, and it tells you it's a dollar and Fed-related story. Well, maybe for all the other commodities, but I disagree with the gold and silver commodities for long term. So you had three of these Fed presidents come out and say that it looks like December might be the deal. And, you know, we can debate whether she will or whether she won't, but it really does come down to, you know, what is really good for the Federal Reserve? That's what it comes down to. What is good for, you know, Jamie Dimon and Goldman Sachs? I mean, they just hired a, you know, I wanted to talk a little bit about it yesterday, you know, the new president. And he's a former Goldman Sachs guy. You know, there's three, I think there, he makes number four of the presidents, of the Fed presidents, that's a Goldman Sachs previous employee. So, you know, that's what the Federal Reserve is concerned about. And that's an important story. That's an important story that this guy got hired as a new president, because he is from that venue. And he is the one that created the TARP program during the 2008 recession, when the markets were crashing and the banks were crashing. He's there for a reason. These are real signs that are telling you what you are ready to face. What is coming down our path? They just don't do this, you know, because they can. You know, they need each other. And it's all for the banks. It's not for you. And if you think it's for you and you think that you're safe because your financial planner tells you you're safe, you're going to lose, and you're going to lose big. And if you think you own mining shares, and if you think that you have your items stored overseas and all these other kind of programs that are promoted on a regular basis, you're sadly mistaken. The only real proven item that will protect you is gold and silver. And it's okay to diversify. You don't have to have 100% of your assets in gold and silver. You can diversify, but make sure that you have enough gold and silver to cover your paper assets. And that's where these guys are all wrong. Oh, go get 5 or 10% of your assets in gold and silver. You'll be fine. To me, I say to that, what's the point? When you have $500,000 plus, what's 5 to 10%? Nothing. It's not going to protect you. You'll wish you had more, and I hear every day, I wish I had listened to you, Melody. So, again, I mean, the mining shares got hammered. When you own mining shares, you do not own gold. You own a corporation. And it really doesn't matter what the true fundamentals of physical gold are. The miners are a different beast. And it's no different than any other paper asset. And all of these markets got weakened with the invention of the ETFs. And yes, I know that they're not backed 100% by gold. They don't have to tell anybody how much gold. I get all that. But the point is, you have millions of dollars that are going in there. And that money at one point in time would have gone into physical gold and some of those miners. Now there's another market. Why did they create that market? It was a great way to help manipulate the markets. And it was another tool that your financial planner could offer you when you mentioned, gee, I want to get some gold. Well, I got this great program for you. I got this ETF. You don't own it. Okay? Buy physical gold and take physical delivery of it. Anyway, so we're back to these guys, you know, from the Federal Reserve that are, you know, will she or won't she? And it looks like it could very well be a quarter point first rate increase in 6 years, but we'll see. And I don't think it really matters, but we'll see. There's student demonstrations, I guess, that were set off today. The Million Student March, there's activists from campuses all around the country that are staging a day of protests against tuition fees, student debt, and of course it was, these protests were inflamed by the recent social justice protests that we saw at Yale and in Missouri. And a statement from the activists reads, "We are people of all colors, genders, and sexual orientation, and we are united to fight for education as a human right." Protesters are calling for a tuition-free public college, cancellation of student debt, and a $15 minimum wage for college workers. Plus a lot of other stuff about straight white male, you know, and rape culture on campus. I mean, really? I mean, earlier in the week, I couldn't believe that the two officials that resigned from the University of Missouri, I mean, what a show of weakness. I mean, is everyone so afraid of what will happen if they say no to these kids? I mean, basically, you hear different stories of why it got started, but supposedly it got started by a rich kid on a hunger strike because of the affordable health care was eliminated for graduate students. Let the kid starve. His dad is worth over $20 million. He made $8.4 million last year. You know, and he's concerned because he can't get health care with, you know, because it was eliminated. And I think they even actually reinstated it. You know, hey, let the kid starve. He wouldn't have gone that long before he would have ate, trust me. And don't forget, there's also this big to-do on a swastika that was made out of poop in one of the bathrooms. But yet, in today's age, where every kid has a phone and there's pictures taken of, you know, they're doing everything. They take pictures 24/7, and there's no pictures of anything, of proof. I mean, it's a sign of how restless everyone is. And everyone's comparing this to the 60s, to all the problems and to the riots that were happening in the colleges in the 60s. And it's, but to me, this is a restlessness of all this division that we see in this country and the politicalness behind it that is being promoted for people's agendas. I mean, it's bizarre and it's frightening. But folks, this is a sign. This is a sign of things to come. And, you know, yeah, it is frightening. But this is reasons why you prepare. This is a reason why you learn. This is a reason why you educate yourself. So you do know what's coming down the pike. And you're not shocked by it. There was an article. Let me see if I can bring it up. Remember Ross Perot, his son? Well, he was talking about all the land that he buys. And he was asked, it was a Bloomberg interview, and he says, "What's the biggest risk to your investments?" He says, "One day your readers are going to wake up and wonder what happened to their assets because of cybersecurity. You really need to be on top of what you own, and you've got to be on top of your record keeping. Imagine one day if a major bank is taken down and the records are gone. Do you think they're going to look for your records? You're going to have to prove to them. And then once that happens, if a major bank is taken down, it doesn't even matter if you have your records, because they're not going to have the money to pay you, and neither will the rest of Wall Street, your investment brokers, your brokerage houses, and so forth. So why not insure that? Why not insure your assets with gold as it was originally designed for? It was originally given to us. It was originally used for over 5,000 years. And that's what upsets me with all of my competitors, but a lot of these guys that I hear everyone follows, they got beautiful information. They got great information. They're very informative about gold and why you need to own gold. But they take you down the wrong path and they don't get you properly positioned. And so with that, I am positioned to quit as we're at the 20-minute break, and Alfred and James Corbett will be joining you. Remember, folks, if you have any questions, call me, 1-800-848-9222. 877-375-4188. We're going to start focusing on the basics of gold and silver and why you need to own it, the fundamentals and what's important, because that's the truth. So stay tuned in a few minutes. Alfred will be here with James Corbett, and thank you for joining me.
Make the aspirin mistake. Aspirin was discovered by mistake during World War II and suppresses your immune system and prevents blood clotting. Don't expose your body to risk when you can use a natural inflammation and pain reliever called Extra Strength Pain Relief by Apothecary Herbs. Discover the power this formula has with salicin to enter the system in 60 seconds to work hard and relieve pain for 12 hours. Whether it's arthritis, sports injury, or flu, you can relieve aches, pain, and swelling with our Extra Strength Pain Relief formula. Call Apothecary Herbs now, toll-free, 866-229-3663. That's 866-229-3663. International callers dial 704-875-8010 or order online at thepowerherbs.com.
Since the beginning of the United States, kings have sought it, nations have fought for it. It has been traded, borrowed, purchased, and stolen. There is a reason for it: to secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity. Invest with the security of gold and silver. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Listen to Financial Survival with your host, Melody Cederstrom, on American Voice Radio Network and Shortwave Radio. Visit DiscountGoldAndSilverTrading.net or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. For the very best in gold and silver trading, call toll-free 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Call now.
American Voice Radio Network is heard on Galaxy 19 at 97 degrees west, transponder 23, frequency 12115, audio PID 2595. AVR is heard on the left side audio channel, and AVR 2 is heard on the right side audio channel. Remember, both AVR and AVR 2 are on Galaxy 19. Same network, double the choices.
Folks, I'm Alfred Addisk, and this is Financial Survival, brought to you by Discount Gold and Silver at 1-800-375-4188. Our guest is James Corbett. He's been on the program as a regular. Most weeks we have James featured on the program for the second and third segments. James has been living and working in Japan since 2004. He started the Corbett Report website in 2007 as an outlet for independent critical analysis of politics, society, history, and economics. He's also editorial writer for the International Forecast, for a weekly newsletter, electronic newsletter, e-newsletter. Hello, James. How are you doing?
I'm doing very well. Thank you for having me on, as always.
Oh, it was a pleasure. Have you seen the interview with where Greg Hunter interviewed Craig Hemke just in the last day or so?
I have not.
All right. It might be. I'm going to ask you some questions about what I understand Hemke to be saying. And he makes some interesting points. Craig Hemke argues that the 300 to 1, actually 293 to to 1 ratio between paper gold contracts and actual physical gold available for delivery at COMEX isn't simply evidence of huge leverage or even fraud. He thinks it's evidence of a huge demand for gold. Now, if Craig Hemke is right, the 300-to-1 ratio is not being used to simply suppress the price of gold. Most people understand that that's one of the effects. He's arguing that it's being used to conceal a huge demand for physical gold, and presumably gold is moving. Masses of gold are moving somewhere. And the question I have is, because I'm associated with the gold market here to some extent here in the United States, I know there's no evidence of a huge demand in the current U.S. wholesale retail gold markets. Precious metals business is right now, it's probably as slow as it's been in 20 years. So how should we understand the record high ratio in the COMEX markets of nearly 300 ounces of paper gold claims on each single ounce of physical gold that's available for delivery? Do you have an explanation, a clarification, whatever?
Well, I mean, there are two sides to all economic transactions. There's the supply side and the demand side. And I think we have to also take into account the fact that demand for the paper is rising, not just demand for the physical delivery. So I think that the longer that this paper fraud, I mean, let's call it for what it is, is perpetuated, and the longer that seems, at least gives the impression of stability, then the more people will be happy to buy into GLD rather than buying actual physical gold. Mm-hmm. So I think some people are quite content with this. The question of whether this represents some sort of, if not an unprecedented, at least some sort of straw breaking the camel back moment for the COMEX, it certainly could, and there's every reason for that to be the case. I mean, as I think we've documented over our time here on this broadcast, and as you always do on this program, I think the demand for gold is real. I think it's growing. I think there's a sanity to that demand, that growing demand, because in a time of not just, you know, government fiat currency, but government fiat currency that's been obviously and completely manipulated over the past several years in the name of quantitative easing and stabilizing the markets and all that jazz, it makes sense that more people would be looking for actual solid, quote-unquote, sound money to have something to fall back on in the case of a hyperinflationary scenario. So, I think I understand why that would be taking place, and it certainly makes sense to me. But I am always a little bit skeptical of these types of predictions about, oh, well, COMEX is about to default, or they're you know, this is some sort of new and unprecedented fraud. They've been perpetuating this for years, and I've only been in this since 2007 when I started the website. I've been really following sort of the alternative media since 2006, and even in my time, I've heard at least a dozen predictions that the COMEX is about to default, including very specific predictions it's coming in this particular month. It always fails to arrive. So yeah. I don't claim to know the ins and outs of how they've managed to perpetuate the fraud this far and this long, but they certainly have. So I'm not going to say that this is ultimately a snapping point. But as I say, all of that caveat aside, there is genuine reason why I think there really is a surge in demand for gold right now and should be.
Do you see a surge in demand or significant demand or change in demand in Japan?
Not in Japan specifically. I think there was some interest in gold towards the beginning of the Abenomics failure that this is turning into, where, of course, they've been trying to inflate the Japanese currency for a couple of years now, and then succeeded to some degree, but probably not the degree they were hoping. There was definitely some interest in gold at the time, as gold, of course, was rising in value relative to Japanese yen, and continues to do so as the yen continues to devalue. But I think that kind of excitement has worn off a little bit. I don't see anything like what is being reported, for example, in China in the last several years, where there's really been quite a phenomenon of gold buying going on there. I don't quite see that. I think people who are in tune and with the economy and are interested in seeking alternative investments are looking at gold here in Japan. But unfortunately, that represents a small amount of the population, as I'm sure it does in America.
Why do you suppose China has encouraged, I mean, part of the reason for the Chinese demand for gold is not just the government's demand. I don't know if that's 90% of the demand or 40% of the demand. I don't know how much is made up by the government. I would assume it's the vast majority. But the government has encouraged the Chinese people to get gold. How many other nations are there on earth that are encouraging their people to get gold rather than their own national currency? Doesn't that strike you as strange? And what's the explanation? Why did Chinese government say, look, you people better get some gold?
Well, yes. No, it is certainly unusual. And I think the reason for that is that China is at the moment attempting to take over more of the gold market in terms of actually affecting the pricing of gold. China has not had much, if any, say of that in international markets until in recent years. Now, with the starting of the Shanghai Exchange and with the greater influence of China, including their participation in the London Gold Fix, I think they're really starting to become an important part of the gold markets. And in order to do that, I think they understand there is a value to having a domestic base for that. So I think that's been part of the reason. There are cultural and historical reasons. Chinese culture has traditionally seen gold as a representative value. And now that there is that rising middle class in China, I think that's where a lot of people just naturally are tending to put some of that money that they finally have to store away for a rainy day. I think that plays a part of it as well. So it's a combination of factors: increase of access to markets, the rise of new markets like the Shanghai Exchange, and historical and cultural factors all play a role in this, as well as just the general rise of the Chinese economy.
You know, the thing that's surprised me in the last 2 weeks or so, I've seen for the first time reports that claim that China's official national debt is $30 trillion, the equivalent of $30 trillion, which is a big surprise to me. I had thought that China was running a budgetary surplus, and that was the reason it was with that budgetary surplus that they were buying gold. We'd heard rumors and stories and claims that they'd purchased 10,000 tons of gold in the last several years. True, maybe false, I don't know. But I had thought that China was essentially a creditor nation, and they would provide some weight against all these debtor nations and the debt-based monetary system. I thought China wants a gold-based system. But if China is, relatively speaking, about as much in debt as the United States, the European Union, and Japan, then what influence are they likely to have on the price of gold that's different from the influence we already see at COMEX? Doesn't China want, being a debtor nation, do they want the price of gold to remain low?
Oh, I mean, here's the thing. This is something that a lot of people don't understand, is that the economic momentum of China in the last several years has been almost completely on the back of a credit expansion that, again, could not take place if China did tie itself to a gold standard, which is exactly why I don't think that's what they're ultimately planning for. So I think China's strategy is very similar for all of the commodities markets generally, including precious metals, which is they want the price as low as possible because they are in a buying mode right now. They are trying to buy up as much resources and access to resources as they can in as many different places in the globe as they can as part of their expansion strategy and as part of, obviously, just trying to feed, clothe, and support a rising standard of living in a growing economy. And so I think they're using, for example, the oil glut right now that's causing the record, or not record low, but the continued low prices in the same way that gold price manipulation in the downward sense is, I think, good for them because they're definitely in a buying mode. Again, this is all good for a country that is in a buying mode like this, that is funding so much of its infrastructure through credit expansion, i.e. creating the money out of thin air. And this is ultimately what China has been doing for years. It's what they're going to continue to do. And in that market, of course, a lower gold price is good for them, which is, again, I think, as I mentioned before, it's why their strategy of starting to reveal their gold holdings is one that's a little bit cat and mouse. They'll reveal a little bit, but they won't reveal it all at one go, because of course that would have a dramatic upward effect on the price of gold that they don't want to see happen, because they're still in a gold buying frame of mind.
Well, that's the problem with this. I don't know when you realized, how long have you understood that China is $30 trillion in debt?
I don't know that figure specifically, but I certainly have known for a while now that their version of, not the quantitative easing, I mean, it's not being called that, but their version of that, the creation of this liquidity, it dwarfs that of the Federal Reserve. I can't remember. I remember seeing, I think in 2013, there was a chart showing in 1 month the amount of credit that the Bank of China created versus the Federal Reserve, and it was just not even comparable. It was orders of magnitude larger. So this is really how the Chinese dragon has been helped along for the last several years.
Well, it's not going to. I was hoping that the Shanghai Gold Exchange would only physical gold. I was hoping before it was established and expecting that the price of physical gold would be set by the Shanghai Gold Exchange, and it would be higher, and people would say, oh my gosh, the price of physical gold is much higher than paper gold. But insofar as I'm able to understand, Shanghai Gold Exchange is essentially relying on pretty much the same prices that are set by COMEX. So they're not helping to distinguish, they're not making a significant effort to distinguish between the price of physical gold and the price of paper gold, much to my dismay. I'd hoped for better, and if they're the big debtor that I now understand them to be, then I guess I can't expect Shanghai Gold Exchange to do much to support the price of gold. Am I missing something here?
No, I think you've got your finger on the pulse of what is, I think, a common failing of understanding for among many people who see this rise of China as a potential bulwark against the kind of craziness that we've seen emerging from the clearly falling apart Western developed countries over the last several years, if not decades, that this could be the rise of some sort of new system or something. But I think China is really belying that with all of their moves in certainly the past year. I think we've seen a number of moves for them to not really fundamentally challenge that order or that system, but really to try to negotiate a better position at that table so that they can join that sort of international order that already exists. And we see that in a number of different ways, whether that comes, for example, in the gold markets, but also in terms of the IMF, in terms of the climate change accord that they're going to probably sign up to in Paris. These types of things are a kind of interesting tension going on right now, where China is certainly making concessions to the international community, not going against them in the way that some people thought or at least hoped that they would.
Well, we've seen. We've seen and been fed a certain amount of information and or propaganda to indicate that the relationship between China and the United States was growing increasingly adversarial. We've got islands in the South China Sea and so on that are being built and they're being tested, and we hear all this, but it turns out they're just as big a debtor as the United States. I read that as evidence they have a lot more in common than I previously supposed. I don't see that there's going to be significant adversity between these two nations. I'm beginning to doubt. I'm beginning to question the idea that there's going to be significant adversity between the United States, for example, or the West and China, because China's just as big a debtor as they are. Is that valid?
Well, I certainly agree with what you're saying here, that they are not going to be fundamentally adverse. And again, it's more complicated than that, because, of course, there are elements in both
wheels
countries
within
that
wheels.
Genuinely. Right, exactly. There are elements that are genuinely opposed, and I think there are people who see it in that time in those rivalrous terms. But I think ultimately, in terms of the international structure, the international monetary order and the banking structure, I think ultimately China is being drawn into the wheelhouse of the existing world order. And it's the question on the table, I think, for the Chinese oligarchs is simply, you know, what position do they have within that order? Not will they fundamentally challenge that order?
I understand. Let's take a break for some commercials. James Corbett and I will be back in a moment. Please stay tuned to Financial Survival. I'm Alfred Addison.
Financial obligations or relationship problems have you feeling stressed out? When life is too much to handle, use Apothecary Herbs' emotional stress formula. Feel calm and more in control with herbs especially combined to provide the organic nutrition your system needs to help you cope. Complete instructions for maximum benefit and a money-back guarantee. You've waited long enough. Call Apothecary Herbs now. Toll free 866-229-3663. That's 866-229-3663. International callers dial 704-875-8010 or order online at thepowerherbs.com.
Food prices have increased over 40%. Energy prices have increased over 20%. Wheat and gas prices have increased over 70%. What's going to be next? Do you see these trends reversing or even stabilizing? All fiat currencies have always failed and collapsed their economies on their way down. The Roman Empire, China, France, Argentina, Finland, Mexico, Russia, and Zimbabwe all tried fiat currency and all collapsed into chaos. Meanwhile, the dollar has lost over 97% of its gold value since 1971, when an ounce of gold was valued at $35. If your assets are in paper, you are in danger. Protect your assets with gold and silver. Visit Discount Gold and Silver Trading at DGScoins.com. That's DGScoins.com or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 800-375-4188. Protect yourself and your family.
Hi, folks. I'm Alfred Addis here with James Corbett on Financial Survival. And we've been talking about, we've been speculating on the consequences of China admitting that its national debt is something comparable to that of the United States. China, the United States, we have a claims we have an $18 trillion national debt. China admitted recently, or at least comes according to a couple of sources in the last few weeks, that they're $30 trillion in debt. Well, in same order of magnitude, the United States national debt is probably much greater than it officially admits, but nevertheless, similar orders of magnitude. If they are both huge debtor nations, then I wonder if they are the adversaries, if they can be the adversaries that we have been led to believe over the past several years. Do they have more in common because of their debt, or so much in common because of their debt, that they can't really sink their teeth into each other's throats? And if it's true that China is becoming more integrated into the Western debt-based monetary system, what does that say for Russia? There's allegedly an alliance between China and Russia. And they are in Syria, and we have thought of it as contrary to the United States, adversarial to the United States. If China's actually going to join the debt-based monetary system, what's happening to Russia? Is Russia going to be abandoned by China's previous alliance?
I think that presupposes alliance, and I think perhaps a better term for Moscow and Beijing would be strategic alignment.
Okay.
I don't think it's as solid as an alliance, and I think there are historical reasons for that, and cultural reasons, and also reasons of strategic interest, that China and Russia have competing interests in various places, like in Central Asia, where China has its own vision of the Silk Road and creation of new transport infrastructure to get Chinese goods and services back and forth across Central Asia into Europe. Whereas Russia has the Eurasian Economic Union, those are directly competing institutions. But of course, they do directly cooperate through the Shanghai Cooperation Organization and things of that sort. But so I think there's an interesting relationship there that isn't as straightforward as alliance. And it does mean that China will diverge with Russia on certain issues in certain places when it suits them. And perhaps, I mean, one could argue, if one is ultimately, a nationalist, that that's the way it should be, cooperation with all nations, but entangling alliances with none. Perhaps that's exemplified in China and Russia right now. They are certainly cooperating on places where it serves both their interests, and there are other places where they diverge. And that doesn't seem to be leading to a lot of tension right now, but in the long run, it certainly could, especially in places like Central Asia.
We've heard for the past several years about the BRICS, the alliance between Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa. The BRICS nations, they were setting up a separate, they were allegedly going to have their own banking system. They were going to have their own system to rival the SWIFT system of dealing with foreign currency transactions and whatever. I haven't heard the BRICS, they haven't been in the news much lately. Are they being co-opted? Are they also falling in, succumbing to the Western debt-based monetary system? Or are they just laying in the bushes waiting to jump up again in the near future?
Well, again, co-opted assumes that they were illegitimate in the first place. And okay. Maybe it's just my conspiratorial mindset, but I've never taken them seriously as a true challenge to the existing order, specifically because the very idea of the BRIC, initially BRIC nations, of course, originated in a paper by Goldman Sachs' Jim O'Neill. And at that time, I believe in 2001, I believe perhaps the initial paper came out where he postulated that this group of four countries at that time, now expanded to five, is going to be the driver of global growth over the next decade or two. And that played out to a certain extent, but not really. And these four, five nations don't really fundamentally have anything that actually makes their economies, really linked in any significant way. It's just that these were four or five developing economies that looked like they were on a similar trajectory. So they were kind of grouped together in a handy dandy acronym that I think helped to sell the idea. To the extent that those nations then actually took up that idea and made a political institution behind it, but it's fairly toothless at this point. It hasn't really accomplished much of anything. The perhaps most significant accomplishment coming at last year's meeting, where they decided on the establishment of their new development bank as a kind of World Bank IMF alternative structure. But even that was pretty quickly undermined, or at least sidelined, by the Chinese, who started their own Asia Infrastructure Investment Bank, which they were obviously more obviously in control of, and more able to use to their own purposes. So they're kind of leaving the new development bank a little bit on the wayside. It's still going, but it hasn't really accomplished anything at this point. And so I think the BRICS idea, has always been more of an idea than a real political reality. And even those nations within the BRICS that really do seem to have stronger ties, like Brazil and India, tend to cooperate through other institutions more so than they do through the BRICS. I can't remember the name of one that both Brazil and India are party to, but something that unites the sort of southern hemisphere economies. And there's those type of alliances, which probably have more meaning ultimately than the BRICS alliance. And if the suggestion was that the BRICS were going to be the leaders of global growth, I think that's been given the lie by what's happened certainly in Brazil in the last few years, where it went from a fairly strong economy, fairly large growth, to really the wheels have fallen off, and Brazil is in a lot of political and economic turmoil right now. So, again, I just don't see this as anything more than kind of an idea that was flirted with but hasn't really been taken seriously by anyone.
You mentioned earlier, you talked about China buying resources around the world. And people have been aware of it. That's not precisely news. They've been doing that for a couple of years. And they're buying gold mines, and they're buying whatever, natural resources, and trying to move into Africa. We have heard those stories. Move into Africa with, you know, significantly. What I'm wondering about is this. You could say that China is, in a sense, trying to establish colonies. All right? They're trying to colonize Africa, for example. We could make that argument. Might not be the proper word choice, but we could make that argument. But I have presumed up until recently that whatever resources it was buying, it was purchasing with capital that it actually had. They're paying with cash, essentially, because I assumed they were a creditor nation. Now I find out they're a debtor nation, which tells me they are buying these gold mines in Africa or wherever. They're buying them on credit. And if that's the case, can you establish colonies? Has there ever been an instance where colonies were established any place in the world based on credit, successfully established long-term? Can they be established on credit, or do you have to go in? Colonies have to be supported by assets.
I think ultimately colonization is supported by the barrel of a gun. So if you have that kind of might, then, you know, they... Unfortunately, might makes, if not right, at least proves ownership in the course of world history. That's why I think that colonization is really the wrong way of thinking about what China's, for example, China's relation to Africa specifically. I think what we can really identify is a type of form of business relationship would be more of the way of looking at China's investment in Africa, whereby China really is cooperating with any and every nation that is amenable to cooperation in Africa, for example, regardless of what their standing in the international community may be in Sudan and other places that have been hotly contested. They're happy to invest in infrastructure and cut those kinds of deals in return for access to resources. I think it really is more of a business relationship than anything else. And in that sense, I mean, I don't think that the people who are benefiting from the construction of that very real infrastructure care whether that infrastructure has been financed by credit or not. I think that the more immediate concern is, you know, do we have these railways? Do we have these highways? Do we have these buildings? I think that's the thing that's visible and what most people would care about in that case. So in that sense, I think China has been quite remarkably successful, and that's why I think sentiment amongst Africans generally is more, I think, in favor of the Beijing model than the Washington model.
Well, what you're implying is that China is actually trying to simply engage in commerce. They are not a warmongering nation out to conquer and impose communism and one thing and another. They are simply out there, let's do a little business, and they're not acting at the point of a gun, and that's got to be encouraging for the people they do business with. They're engaged in commerce more so than war.
We just have to contrast what's happened, for example, in Libya with, you know, explicit NATO intervention, or in other northern African nations with French intervention, or what's happening on Africa's doorstep now and just across the Gulf with Yemen and places like that, to see what the model is for Western influence in the region versus China. What military engagements have they been engaged in anywhere near the continent of Africa any time in the last, well, in recorded history? I mean, China is not aggressive, is not militarily aggressive, at least not at this point. And I think, I mean, we would be naive to assume that the way that China acts, has acted to this point, is the way they will always act into posterity. But at any rate, I think in terms of the actual threat to global peace and stability at the moment is certainly not coming from the Chinese military.
I think this may be the last question. We've got about 4 minutes left. I'm much impressed by the idea by discovering that China's allegedly $30 trillion in debt. That really colors my thinking right now. And I look at it and I see, look, the United States is at least $18 trillion in debt, and the European Union is in debt for however much, I don't know exactly, and Japan is certainly in debt. These are three of the four major world economies. The fourth major world economy is China. And all four of them are ensnared in debt. Does this lay a foundation for supposing the four major economies in the world will wake up one of these days, or will wake up and they'll all be standing together and say, guess what, we've just canceled all of our debt? Is that sort of thing feasible? Is it possible? Is it just an unlikely something to worry about?
The idea of some sort of grand bargain in between various countries is always on the table, but it's a question of how much of the debt that actually pertains to. So, I mean, when you're talking about this number, the last that I saw with regards to total debt load in China, it was 28 trillion. So I guess 30 trillion is just an update on that number, which came from earlier this year. But of that 28 trillion at the time, the majority of it was bank loans to corporations. Then there were shadow bank loans to corporations. Then there were corporate bonds. There's corporate borrowing from overseas. There's bank loans to households. And then there's central government bonds and bank bonds. So really, central government bonds only accounts for 16% of China's GDP. And the total debt load altogether is something like 250% of GDP. So government debt in China is really only a small chunk of that 30 trillion.
So what you're telling me is that the 30 trillion debt that I've heard from Bill Holder, for example, it's not the debt of the central government. It's not the national debt per se. It's the total amount of debt that's owed by everyone in China, corporations, shoeshine boys, whatever. Put them all together, we've got $30 trillion in debt?
That's my understanding, yes. Right. So this is total debt load, not just the national debt.
All right. Well, I can understand that. That I just could not get the idea of China's $30 trillion in debt, meaning the government. That just did not compute with me. Nevertheless, what's the chances that we will see, if it's a debtor nation, the United States is a debtor nation, Europe's a debtor nation, Japan's a debtor nation, what's the chances that we're going to see all four of them stand up at one time and say, too bad, guess what, we got a new deal, and a reset.
Yes.
Is a
global
reset,
default global reset, yes. It is a possibility. It is something they could do. And in a sense, I mean, we saw something like that with Bretton Woods. It wasn't exactly that kind of global default, but it was a complete global restructuring agreed on in secret negotiations behind the scenes that were sort of suddenly sprung on the public. Oh, here's a new way to back up the entire monetary system of the world. It certainly can be done. It has been done. I'm sure it will be done at some point, because as I think we've documented here, the petrodollar regime that's pertained for the last few decades is falling apart, and there clearly are competitors to that idea. It's only a question of when and how that is sprung on the public. But unfortunately, if the Bretton Woods example is anything to go by, it requires massive crisis on the scale of a global war. It might not take the form of global war, but something of that nature would be probably necessary to psychologically condition the public to be on board with that. And I think that's, again, unfortunately, a very real possibility moving forwards through the 21st century, that the next major crisis will be used for the next step towards a new creation of new global banking structures, monetary structures, these types of things.
We'll have to relieve that for another. We'll talk about that more next time we talk. I'm Alfred Addis here with James Corbett from thecorbettreport.com. Some of the best material you can find on the internet. Stop in thecorbettreport.com. Thank you for being on the program, James. Look forward to talking to you next week. In the meantime, may the good Lord bless you, me, the audience, and Frank the producer. Bye-bye.
All night, I work all day to pay the bills I have to pay. Ain't it sad? And still, there never seems to be a single penny left for me. That's too fast. In my dream, I have a plan. If I got me a wealthy man, I wouldn't have to work at all. I'd fool around and have a ball. Money, money, must be funny.